We look at a situation like this. We're all in this room, and there is a poisonous snake in this room. What do we do? Do we set up a committee on snakes to carry out a remote sensing on the snakes and do some special studies and try to think of what venom it will have? And then we do remote sensing from afar off and then measure it and spend some time on a committee of snakes. What do? We kill it.
Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, the weekly independent climate change bulletin that's made for Resonance 104.4 FM in central London and syndicated to community radio and other independent media around the globe. At the top of the show, you heard Dr. Victor Fedeke, head of the Nigerian delegation, speaking at the United Nations climate change talks in Barcelona at the end of last week. Poor countries charge that the rich countries have been overwhelming the negotiations with an inordinate and unnecessary amount of technical detail that has been obscuring the main issues. Strip back the technical detail, they say, and it's clear to see that the reason that many commentators describe the talks as being in deadlock is because rich countries aren't honouring their legal and moral obligations. This reality was exposed last week when the African delegation requested that more time be spent on raising the level of rich country emissions cuts in line with the science, rather than on supplementary technical issues. Adequate levels of rich country cuts were supposed to have been finalised earlier this year. A process bogged down in technical detail is not the only rich country tactic that the poor majority world has to deal with. In an excellent extended feature in last Saturday's Guardian magazine, environment editor John Vidal detailed some of the ways in which the process is weighted against the poor. The language is designed to be incomprehensible, says one British diplomat. Poor countries can only afford small delegations, while rich country delegations can be as large as they like, flying legal advisers in to help with the tiniest detail. John writes, in comparison with the EU or the US, the G77 has no offices, no permanent staff, and no budget to meet in advance of conferences. Delegates from poor countries must grasp highly complex technical issues in their second or even third languages. Rich countries will have whole teams of people to take it in turns to be on the front line of the negotiations, staying fresh while their less well-resourced opponents are exhausted. These very real power imbalances are just the tip of the iceberg. A natural companion to John's piece is a paper produced by the campaign coalition Oil Watch back in June called Divide and Rule: The Politics of Climate Change Negotiations, which details the variety of dirty tactics that the rich world has been known to use both in the World Trade Organization negotiations as well as in the UN climate talks. Rich world negotiators have worked their way into poor country delegations under the guise of capacity building and have gone on to argue positions that are against the interests of the developing world. Attempts have been made to buy countries off and split the G77 plus China negotiating bloc using short-term promises that are not met, as well as threatening countries with cuts in aid budgets and loss of trade preferences. Political pressure is used to attempt to remove effective southern negotiators. Only last week, we heard that after the African bloc took a stand at the talks in Barcelona, the chair of the African bloc, Kamel Djemouai, was immediately spirited back to Algeria, and a number of other African delegations were reported to have received strong phone calls from their capitals. Developing country parties have expressed their concern that rich nations have been using a range of other forums to advance their agendas. These include the G20 Club of Rich Nations and the Obama-convened Major Economies Forum, which are by their very nature undemocratic, as they exclude the majority poor world and do not work on a consensus basis and are not open and transparent. Rich countries also dominate and distort the media narrative to their advantage. On this programme, we've documented how UK Energy and Climate Change Secretary Ed Miliband has been amongst those perpetuating the lie that there is a political and scientific consensus around limiting global temperature rise to 2 degrees C, when in fact there are some 80 countries demanding that global warming be kept as far below 1.5 degrees C as possible. And, after the latest IPCC report, it would be hard to find any scientist that would tell you that 2 degrees could be considered safe. It would require a whole programme to take apart the public position of the UK and Europe and correct the countless false impressions that have been advanced. In the upcoming talks in Copenhagen, the UK's Department of Energy and Climate Change alone are reportedly scheduling 2 press conferences a day. It seems that the rich world is intent on drowning out the voices of the poor majority world by sheer person power alone. And now that the end game of the negotiations arrives, the action increasingly moves into so-called informal sessions behind closed doors.
In the Poznan talks, I said, well, these guys are having a criminal talks. You know, they want to have closed sessions, you know. Why do they have closed sessions? Only gangsters have closed sessions. Sessions should be open to everybody to hear. Why? Because they want the United States, you know, Bush government wants to push the others to accept this and to accept that, and all big politicians with the big businessmen are doing the same thing.
13 years. It's great to have John Vidal on the case and reporting on the ground in both Bangkok and Barcelona, but I think he misrepresents the nature of the so-called deadlock at the talks in the same way that many northern journalists do. He says that in these talks, nobody moves until everybody moves. Actually, the poor are waiting for the rich world to honour their obligations under the United Nations Framework Convention, which everyone signed up to back in 1992. Article 3.7 of the Convention says that the extent of poor world action depends upon the level of finance and technology provided by the rich world. Developing countries are negotiating in good faith that there will be money forthcoming to enable their participation and also to enable them to adapt to the impacts of climate change that are both happening now and are already locked into the future. The poor will move when the rich move, but to date there is no serious money on the table. Here's the head of the South African delegation, explaining the approach that every country at the talks agreed to under the so-called Bali Roadmap in 2007.
2 years ago in Bali, we reached an agreement as to how to proceed for the next 2 years leading up to Copenhagen. In essence, that agreement was to continue negotiating ambitious quantified emission reduction commitments for developed countries that are party to the Kyoto Protocol. And under the convention, to negotiate comparable commitment, a commitment which is comparable to those taken under the Kyoto Protocol for those developed countries which are not part of the Kyoto Protocol. In balance with that, we have an agreement for developing countries to take action on condition that that action is supported by finance, technology, and capacity building. And we agreed that it would be a priority for Copenhagen to deliver a comprehensive program on adaptation, in particular, considering that there is unavoidable climate change happening and the extremely vulnerable countries, developing countries, are most severely hit and least responsible for causing the problem. So these are the elements of what we have already agreed. The challenge that we face is that of recent meetings, Bangkok and prior meetings, we have a shift in position of developed countries whereby they wish now to not negotiate a second commitment period under Kyoto Protocol. That for us is a reneging on the agreement which has already been struck in Bali. And it places the outcome in Copenhagen under severe threat. a successful outcome in that circumstance would not be accepted by the G77 in China.
There is a history of broken promises by the rich world, something acknowledged by the UNFCCC Executive Secretary, Ivo de Boer, at the UN talks in Barcelona just last week.
Arthur Max from Associated Press. You have said before that developing countries have, or that there is a history of broken promises by developed countries to the developing world. I wonder if you think that the status of what comes out of Copenhagen will be enough to reassure the developing countries that whatever is agreed will stand and will not be broken.
I think that a Copenhagen commitment in the form of a list of individual industrialized country commitments for emission reduction commitments for 2020 will be a huge boost to confidence. And I believe that a second list that specifies what share individual rich nations will contribute to the 10 billion that I've been talking about will be a second huge boost of encouragement to developing countries to get a legal instrument in place. Of course, I cannot guarantee that a promise will not be broken, but I do believe that if you get two lists of the kind that I described, it makes it very uncomfortable for any self-respecting nation to, in the subsequent few months afterwards, when we will be finalizing this treaty, wiggle out of that.
No trust-building efforts have been in evidence over the last 2 years, and now the UN Secretariat seems resigned to a non-binding agreement coming out of Copenhagen. This is an outcome that is preferred by the United States, but strongly opposed by the majority poor world. Worse, Ivo de Boer seems ready to accept that these non-binding targets will, at best, be based on old science.
Thank you, William Marsden from the Montreal Gazette. I just wanted to ask you a question about the science. About the science. There's been an awful lot of talk here this week and also in Bangkok about the fact that since the IPCC report of 07, there's been considerable scientific evidence that things are getting much, much worse. And you've got African countries and the small island states insisting that we have to increase our targets to a much greater extent. In view of this science, which is quite broad, what do you think the effect of this most recent science should have on these negotiations and the targets that people are laying out or that you expect them to lay out?
First of all, I would say that Copenhagen is not the last climate change conference we'll see, and that the fourth assessment report of the IPCC is not the last scientific report we will see. And I expect, I mean, what are we trying to do here? We're trying to get to an 80% emission reduction from industrialized countries by mid-century, and potentially a 50% emission reduction for the globe as a whole. Copenhagen, in not even in my wildest dreams, is going to deliver all of that in one fell swoop. In other words, we will have to come back to this topic as we understand the science better, as we understand the economics better, and as we begin to see that actually acting on climate change drives change in a very constructive way. Having said that, I believe that the recent findings coming from the scientific community are having an impact and are making it clear to people that the sense of urgency should be significantly increasing and that the window of opportunity that we have to address this issue is getting smaller.
Rich world cuts on the table remain unchanged at the end of Barcelona. In aggregate, they reportedly amount to between an 11 to 18% cut. This is expected to be consistent with a 3-degree rise in global average temperature, at which point a plethora of so-called positive feedbacks are likely to have kicked in, leading to uncontrollable, devastating, and catastrophic climate change. Faced with the spectre of politics as usual, failing to ensure the safety of life on Earth in what is our last chance as a global community, a number of activists around the world have pledged to up their game. On the final day of the talks in Barcelona last Friday, Anna Keenan and Sara Svensson held a press conference announcing the start of the Climate Justice Fast. Here's an extended edit of that press conference, with which we end this week's programme. For more, visit the Climate Radio Archive at www.climateradio.org. Or for more about the fast, visit www.climatejusticefast.com. Thanks for listening.
My name is Anna, I'm 23 years old and I'm from Brisbane, Australia. Aside from being a full-time voluntary, mostly voluntary climate change activist, I'm also a jitterbug swing dancer and a former circus acrobat. I love life and I love health and I love and respect my body as well. I've attended the Bali and Poznan COP meetings as part of the global youth climate movement. I have a very strongly interdisciplinary academic background. I have a degree in physics and mathematics and another one in economics and environmental studies. And since graduating from university, I've sat on a number of government advisory boards for climate change and education for sustainability. I've worked for professional NGOs. I've been arrested on top of a coal train in civil disobedience. And 2 weekends ago, I organized a 350 action for the Global Day of Action with 300 people dancing the Charleston in the rain in Amsterdam as part of a celebration of sustainable lifestyles. So you could say that I have a very diverse activist experience, with having tried a lot of different methods. And what I can see and what I feel right now is that all of the different methods of activism, whether it's meeting with governments or whether it's yelling in the streets, aren't making the change that we need to see happen. And so that's why we're taking this higher level of activism, to leave activism as usual behind and to take the strongest form of action that I can personally take. Gandhi said, and Gandhi is a great inspiration to all of us at Climate Justice Fast, he said that under certain circumstances, fasting is the one weapon that God has given us for use in times of utter helplessness. And I think that now we have perhaps reached that time of utter helplessness, and it's time to resort to this extreme form of action. We haven't eaten today, and we will be continuing our hunger strike, drinking water only indefinitely. We expect that our fast will last throughout and beyond the end of the Copenhagen summit, 43 days from now. We're supported by people in countries all around the world. Countries like the USA, the Philippines, Bhutan, Australia, Nepal, India, Sweden, and France, to name just a few. We also have hundreds of supporters who are fasting today, including some here at this conference. And long-term hunger strikes like ours are beginning also in Australia and in the US. We are undertaking this hunger strike called Climate Justice Fast because the whole world, from our next door neighbours through to US President Obama, needs to wake up to the reality of the unfolding tragedy of climate change. Our hunger strike is a moral response to an immoral situation. We are part of the growing global climate change movement, and this hunger strike is a concrete demonstration that this movement is ready to do whatever it takes to ensure climate justice. Put simply, that is our demand, climate justice. Now, it's a very complex term and it's thrown around a lot. It's got layers of meaning. But in the briefest form, we believe that climate justice has four key elements. The first is meeting the science, 350 parts per million stabilisation level, so that future generations and our children today and people in our generation can have a fighting chance. Second is the need for climate finance for developing countries of at least US $160 billion per year from 2012 to 2020. Third, and this is a very personal demand, is the end of overconsumption wherever it exists, whether that's in our personal lives or whether that's as whole nations. And we need to allow the developing world to consume to a sustainable level above the level of poverty that they're currently at. And fourth, we need to see the end of fossil fuels within our lifetimes. We have 40 years until 2050. I'm going to be 65 in 2050, and by that time, I want to see a fully renewable society without the use of fossil fuels. It's true that these demands amount to a total transformation. It's radical, and it may seem unachievable, but it's the truth. And it's what we desperately need to solve the climate crisis. To continue business as usual and politics as usual will not achieve these demands. Politics, as usual, represents a massive injustice to the most vulnerable nations, to the world's poorest people, to our planet itself, and to all future generations. Both governments and individuals need to rapidly wake up and become fully conscious of the gravity of the situation that we're now in, and to do everything possible to get us out of it. We, as part of this hunger strike, intend to provide that urgent wake-up call. We urgently need to shift away from business as usual into an all-out effort for collective survival. It'll be a huge challenge to solve climate change, it's true, but it is not impossible. We believe that humanity can solve climate change if we come together, because we know in our hearts that no matter how hard it will be, and no matter how much change it requires, that it is quite simply worth the effort. We trust in the fundamental goodness of all people, and we ask that everybody, from normal citizens to world leaders, search within themselves to find the truth, to find what is right, and to do the right thing. We know and we understand the risk to our health. We're both, you know, not particularly large young women, but we believe that the risk to the planet is far, far greater, and that's why we're willing to put our health on the line. We're undertaking the hunger strike because of our global government's inaction, and if that inaction continues, it is about to make us as humanity complicit in the greatest crime against humanity that the world has ever seen. The Prime Minister of Ethiopia described it best when he said that this great injustice of climate change is that those who have contributed nothing to its genesis will suffer the most from its consequences. But politics now is standing by, talking and negotiating, and doing nothing. The UN climate talks process, we know, is now at risk of being delayed one further year, bringing us 1 year closer to the scientific tipping point. This is now a battle between political tipping points and scientific tipping points, if we haven't already passed that tipping point. Governments and people everywhere are resisting the political tipping point, saying that the problem is too big and too difficult for them to commit to action. We say that this is just bad psychology. What about our grandparents and our ancestors who fought the battles for women's rights, for freedom, for the end of fascism, for democracy, for the end of slavery? All of these were huge problems, and they seemed insurmountable at that time. But they had faith that we could win these battles, and they had the dedication to overcome these battles. The same can happen with climate change. The size of a challenge is a poor excuse for inaction. No matter how difficult a challenge is, like all the great political challenges of the past, we must embrace the challenge and do whatever it takes to solve it, even if that is a hunger strike. Personally, I believe that politics and humanity is capable of solving the climate crisis, but it will require us to rise above the politics and to accept personal and national sacrifices in the name of a greater collective good. There is simply too much good and too many good people in the world to allow climate change to continue. Yes.
William Morrison from the Montreal Gazette. I'm just curious, are you going to have any medical staff hanging around you at all during this fast?
It would be unwise to have no medical supervision, so we will be having some medical supervision just to advise us about our medical condition and what consequences can be expected, but they won't be providing us treatment unless we decide to end the fast. But we're going to have a good agreement with whoever our medical practitioners are that they're not to compel us to end the fast. They're just to provide unbiased, objective medical advice.
Yeah, Ben Webster again from The Times. How do we know that you are actually not going to eat anything? I mean, you're both very media savvy, and you're very aware of the importance of headlines.
The truth or not, so...
Well, I mean, David Blaine, the illusionist, he sat in a perspex box outside Tower Bridge in London for 30 days and well, it was very easy to see whether he was eating anything. But I mean, how do we know? We're just going to have to look at your physical condition.
Perhaps that's actually one of the things that we'll be asking the medical supervisors to verify. We can have the medical supervisors create, reports that can be released to the media to verify the authenticity of the fast. But, you know, I have no intention to deceive the public, not at all. So I wouldn't call myself very media savvy at all. I'm a total amateur.
Thank you very much. I'm Agnes. I come from Zambia. And I'm greatly inspired by the move that you have taken. As I sit here and listening to what the participants are asking, I just reflect back home and I say, I see this year I've seen people dying in my country without food because of the failed rains. And I just feel so touched looking at people here from the northern country concerned about people voluntarily going without food, but actually people are going without food, and even in the hospitals there's no support. We've seen mothers go failing even to take their malnourished children. I pledge to bring some physical photos in Copenhagen, and I think we really need the northern partners, the young generation, to show such a commitment, because it's really, really bad back home, and certainly we need climate justice, and backing you up. I think we need more of such courage. I would really envy and I support you fully. I don't know whether there are any linkages you have with African NGOs to bring to reality exactly what is happening, what people are suffering, not voluntarily going without food, but literally going without food. And the only support that government could do was to provide a kilogram of maize to a household that has been going without food for some time. It's really bad, and I think we really call for climate justice, and I'm fully supporting you.
Thank you very much. This action is very strongly undertaken in solidarity with those people in developing nations who are, as you say, suffering the greatest and most dire consequences, and you've outlined them in a very clear way just now, but who have contributed the least to the problem, and that's exactly what climate justice is about. That's what Climate Justice Fast is for. Just going without food today has made me realise when looking around this conference centre, when walking through the centre of Barcelona, how plentiful food is and consumption in our society, and how mindlessly we think about consumption. We buy food and we consume goods without thinking of the consequences, but the consequences are very real and very dire, just like in Zambia, as you've outlined there. As part of the global youth climate movement, we have strong connections in both Southeast Asia, South America and Africa as well. The African Youth Initiative in Climate Change is a great inspiration to us. There's one colleague of mine, Grace, who's from Kenya. And when she was in Bangkok at the last negotiations, she said in a press conference there that when I came to Bangkok, there was literally no water coming out of the tap, and there was no electricity, and there was no food, and people were starving. And this is exactly why we're undertaking this fast. It is a voluntary action, and it's much, much harder for those people for whom it's involuntary. So thank you very much for your comments, and we do stand in full solidarity with the least developed nations.